Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Dinfos Way. My name is Jack Rouse. I'll be your host for this episode. I'm a former Navy journalist and a current training instructor here at Dinfos. Joining me today is Dan Rodericks. He's a longtime columnist for the Baltimore Sun and a local radio and television personality who's won several national and regional journalism awards over a reporting, writing, and broadcast career spanning five decades. He's also the author of three books, and he joins us today to talk about his career, being a professional communicator, and some advice for young journalists just starting out. Mr. Rodericks, thanks for joining us.
Oh, call me Dan. John, thank you for inviting me here.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to see you sitting here. I'm a huge fan of yours. I have been throughout the majority of your career. It's great to see you sitting across
decades,
the table.
Five decades, John? I don't think
not
so.
Not that long. No, not that long. But I remember seeing you on BAL and listening to your show and reading your columns, and I'm just a big fan.
This is my 50th year working on newspaper.
Wow.
I started at 19 in Quincy, Massachusetts, on a daily newspaper, using a typewriter in a newsroom full of cigarette, cigar, and pipe smoke. And it was great. It was a great experience. I got hooked that first summer of 73, and I'm here, still here 50 years later.
That's amazing. That speaks to kind of your skill and talent in the career field.
Yeah, I'm a glutton for punishment working in this field, but actually I've enjoyed it. I don't feel like I've worked a day in my life.
Yeah.
I feel very lucky. And when I got to Baltimore, within a few years, they made me a columnist. I was 24 years old, and they said, here, write a column. I said, are you talking to me? And I also feel lucky because I was able to work in radio and TV in Baltimore without having to leave town to try those careers elsewhere. So I got to do all of it. I got to do a podcast. I've got to do radio shows and a TV show. So I feel very fortunate.
And you've been basically all over the career field, essentially.
Yeah. So ask me whatever you like about any of those things.
Well, the first thing I want to ask you is what made you decide to become a journalist or a communicator?
Well, actually, I was interested in sports. I was a jock in high school, and I liked Sports Illustrated magazine. I read it like crazy. I thought it was beautifully written, and there was some great photographs in those days in the Sports Illustrated. That's the title of the magazine. And I got hooked in sports writing. I wanted to be a sports writer, and I started doing that in college. And if you asked me to be a sports writer today, I could do it too, because I follow sports. And something happened there in the summer of 73. It was Watergate summer. It was the year that the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, and some other national newspapers, the Chicago Tribune, did all that investigative reporting on the Watergate scandal, and that really impressed me. And I was in a newsroom in Quincy, Massachusetts, working for a local daily, around all these interesting people. I've got to say that over all these years working at newspapers, I've always been around interesting people. The newspaper reporters and editors that I've known all this time, men and women, are fascinating people. They're well-read. They care about politics. They care about civic life. They care about national issues, local issues. They're conversant in all these things. They read books. They go to movies. They read poetry. The atmosphere in a newspaper newsroom that I got hooked on was collegial. They were full of characters. These people are also interesting people, you know, some kind of goofy people and really serious people. And I just loved it. I just loved that collegial atmosphere of the newsroom and wanted to be a part of that. And then there's all the action that comes with it, covering fires, covering crime, covering courts, politics, city council hearings, sometimes boring hearings. But, you know, the challenge was to write an interesting story based on a three-hour zoning hearing over whether somebody can add a new dock to their waterfront property, that kind of stuff. You know, that's all local stuff that I did back then. But it was a great experience, writing obituaries, learning to get it right, to get the facts right, and being around people who were very careful and cared about the facts. That's how I got started. So I guess that's why I got hooked. I just love the action, and I love the act of writing, trying to tell people a story.
You know, I've been reading your columns in The Sun for a very long time. What would you say are the best qualities of your writing style, and how did it evolve over time?
My best qualities? Listen, at 24, and they made me a columnist. I've been a reporter since I was 19, in internships in college. And then after college, I was a city hall reporter in Baltimore. I covered federal courts. I did general assignment, feature writing. So when they made me a columnist, I thought, what are you, serious? I was 24 years old. I didn't think anybody cared what I had to say about anything. Now, when you say columnist, it infers opinion. It infers a point of view that you don't get from straight reporting, right? So I understood that what they wanted was an entertaining local column that had an edge to it, that had my own take on things. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel confident in my opinions about anything yet to go on opinionizing in this column. And I think it also made editors uncomfortable, but they wanted it to have an edge. So when I say that, I mean, what do you mean by an edge? It means when you go to a courtroom to observe a trial, say, a day of a trial, a day-long testimony, and come back and write a column. It means you're adding your own take to it. You're reporting facts, but it's with your edge, your take on things. And it might be a little seem liberal to some people. It might seem more conservative to others. Whatever it is, it reflects your personality in some way. You're saying to the reader, look, I went to the courtroom yesterday and observed this homicide trial. This is how it played on my mind. This is how it affected me. And this is what I saw. It doesn't mean that's exactly what happened. It means it's my take on things. So I felt more confident doing reporting with a little bit of an edge. And then as time went by, I developed more of a voice, more of my own voice, more of a distinctive voice, I think. So when you ask me about quality, I say it's fact reporting. It's opinion that's based on facts. Based on my reporting, I still do a lot of reporting. This week, before I came here, I wrote a couple of columns. One about horsemanship in Maryland, the horse ownership in Maryland, and on dolphins in the Chesapeake Bay. So, I took on two mammals this week. It's a little different for me, but both of those required quite a bit of reporting and reading background to get to where I'm confident to sit down and write what I want to say about horses in Maryland and dolphins in the Chesapeake Bay.
So at this stage of your career, do you still have to pitch ideas to a news director or someone, or do you essentially come up with your own story ideas?
Well, yeah, that's another thing. If you ask my editor what my finer quality is, that I come up with stories all the time. They do not have to feed me stories. They never did. Right from the beginning, I guess I had just a curious mind. And older reporters at The Sun, I was surrounded by some great reporters who have been doing it a long time. They sort of instilled in me this idea that you got to be forever curious, and that you read a news story that a reporter writes about some issue in City Hall, and maybe there's a paragraph in there that jumps out at you and says, hey, this needs a little bit more. There's something really interesting here that the reporter just sort of mentioned in passing. So pick up on it and go with it, that kind of thing. Spend a good amount of time thinking about what you read and what your take is going to be. So, yeah, editors occasionally will throw something to me, but most of the time I'm coming up with ideas. And they trust me, and I've been doing it for so long, right? They kind of trust me to come up with, hopefully, an interesting column 3 times a week for the Sun readers. And, you know, they don't all work. They're not all fascinating. Some I get more response than others. But I think I've reached a certain level where I say, hey, my judgment's pretty good about this. I think I know what an interesting story is or what people are thinking about or might want to know more about. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And when you have a story, what is your writing process like?
Well, let's take if you want to take the subject of dolphins, for instance, do you want to do that?
Sure.
I'll just run that down because that's the freshest one in my mind. It's the one I just finished, mm-hmm. right? So we've been getting reports for the last 5 or 6 years, 7, maybe 8 years now, of dolphins in the Chesapeake Bay. And people find this unusual because they are Atlantic bottlenose dolphins, and the Chesapeake Bay is an estuary with fresh water in it, and it gets terrible grades every year from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation for its water quality and its general health, right? Mm-hmm. So what are dolphins doing here? You think dolphins want to be in clean water where there's plenty of food. and warmer water, maybe. So what are they doing here in Maryland? And is this, how unusual is this? So a guy writes to me and says, I was in my kayak in the Wye River, which is over in Queen Anne's County on the eastern shore. And I thought, that's pretty far north for dolphins to be up in the bay. And then I look a little further, because I hadn't really looked into this much at all. I know we've had stories in the paper and on television about dolphins in the bay. There have been sightings of them. Well, I come to find out the University of Maryland, for instance, has a dolphin watch app that people have put on their phones to report where they see dolphins. And you can go online and see where people have reported dolphins, and they've reported them all over the bay, all the way up to, like, Cecil County. And the Potomac River, at the mouth of the Potomac, where it reaches the bay, is full of dolphins. So I said, well, that's pretty interesting. I had no idea that there were that many people are reporting. And then you find out, I come to find out just from Googling, right, that there's a Dolphin Potomac project that's focused just on dolphins in the Potomac River. And then you find out that they've been swimming all the way up to near the nation's capital, to near Alexandria. So what's going on? So then I said, okay, well, I got to talk to somebody who's working on this dolphin project. And I found a woman named Anne-Marie Jacoby, who's with Duke University assigned to this dolphin project. And she spends all her time, in the summer especially, tracking dolphins, listening for them with listening devices, taking photographs of them, interviewing watermen, Chesapeake watermen, about where they see them and how often they see them. And she's at the point now where she and her colleagues know these dolphins. Like, they're the same dolphins every year. They take photographs of the dorsal fins of dolphins and use a software to identify them. They've identified 2,000 individual dolphins just in the Potomac waters.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. They've seen a birth of a baby dolphin in the water. They've seen plenty of juvenile dolphins with their mothers. And so there's all this stuff going on. And she's doing all this research, this Anne-Marie Jacoby. So I ask her some definitive questions, like, are dolphins here to stay? Or do they live here all year round? She says, we don't know yet. And that, you don't really want to know that. You don't want to hear that when you're a reporter. You're looking for something definitive, right? What do you mean, we don't know yet? We don't know yet. There's only been 7 years of data collected, and that's not enough for us to make a conclusion about dolphins in the bay. And I said, okay. So I played off this idea of we don't know yet in the column, and I finished writing it yesterday and filed it this morning after I read it one more time with my editor. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a summary of where we are with dolphins. Like, what's going on out there? What do we know about them? We don't know everything, like she says, but we know a lot already. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating. They're here mostly because the water's gotten warmer, the Chesapeake Bay. Part of it has to do with climate change. And there's more salinity in the water because in years when we don't get as much rain, the Chesapeake has more salt in it, so they come for that. And there's plenty of food. There's plenty of fish in the bay for them to eat. So even though the Chesapeake Bay Foundation gives these low grades to the general health of the bay, the dolphins don't seem to mind. I mean, they might be telling us something else about the quality of the bay water. So that's my process. That's what I wrote, 900 words on dolphins in the bay. And if you read that column, hopefully you'll learn something from it.
So you do your research, you do your interview. When you sit down to write, is there an outline that you follow almost, or is it different every time?
Well, I work at home a lot, right? Ever since COVID, the pandemic, it sort of broke up our newsroom, and a lot of us work from home. So, yeah, I'll sit there at my desk thinking, how am I going to start this? You know, it's like when you are a pilot of a jet. The toughest part is the taking off and the landing for me. So you want to write a smart lead, a smart top, to hook people to read it, and you want to finish with some panache. You want to tie the bow at the end in 900 words in a column. So I'll get up from my desk and go cook something in the kitchen or take a walk and think about it. And then I came back and I sat down and I thought, how am I going to start this piece? And I said, well, I think my lead was something like, even though they have these big brains, you wouldn't expect the bottlenose dolphins of the Chesapeake Bay to read a report card. And if they knew what the Chesapeake Bay Foundation said in its annual report card on the bay, maybe they wouldn't stick around. So it's sort of like that's sort of how I began the piece. And it was after that, I wouldn't say it's easy organizing all those facts in a readable, but, you know, I've done this for a long time, and I think I reached a certain level of competence about doing that. And the more you write, the more you do this, the better you get at it. For most people, I think that's true.
Yeah, 100%, obviously.
I think it's true. I think it's true about anything, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. Really? Yeah, for sure. Do you have deadlines at the paper?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah, sure.
And what are they, and how do you meet them?
Well, let's see. You know, my column goes up online almost as soon as I file it and an editor reads it. So that's on Tuesday. Usually by noon or 1 o'clock, I've finished a column that will be in print on Wednesday. So we still print the Baltimore Sun. We still have readers who want to hold that newspaper in their hands, including my wife. And then I have another deadline on Thursday at noon or 1 o'clock. It goes up online immediately, and then is in print on Friday. And then on Friday, I turn around and I write a piece on Friday or finish it by 1 or 2 o'clock that goes up online over the weekend and is in print on Sunday. So I write three a week like that. Yeah, that's my deadline. Yeah.
Is there have you found techniques to make sure you always meet them, or has it been a struggle sometimes?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I'm trying to think of, you know, I like writing on deadline. I went to the Freddie Gray police officer's trials in Baltimore. I sat in for lots of testimony in the trials of police officers in the Freddie Gray death. And I wrote on deadline each day. Very quickly. I mean, because we're online now, they'll take my column almost at any time and put it up there, because people are reading the newspaper online 24/7, it seems like. You know, this is very interesting. I started on the Evening Sun, which is a print newspaper that lasted until 1995. So we had the Evening Sun and we had the Morning Sun. And I'd come to work at 6 a.m. on the Evening Sun. And we'd work a full shift, and then the Morning Sun people would come to work in the afternoon and work through the night. And it was practically a 24-hour newspaper. There was I shouldn't say that. It was like between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m., there was nothing, right? Now it's like a 24/7 operation where you can click on the Sun website or on our app at any time and get something new, whether it's an Orioles score or whatever, at night. So it's almost like we're back to those days when we had two newspapers and almost a 24-hour operation. So if I want to, if something big breaks in the news, like we had that shooting and we had a mass shooting in South Baltimore, in the Brooklyn area of Baltimore, and my editor called me up. It was a Sunday, and he said, "Can you knock out something on this? Can you say something about this?" And I said, I guess I can. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a subject I've written a lot about, you know, guns and violence in Baltimore. So I wrote something in a couple of hours, and they had it up online, and it did very well with readership. So,
you know, as a Baltimore native, I think I mentioned I've been seeing your work for a really long time. And one aspect of your style that I've always enjoyed is your willingness to be real and to tell the truth about things. Here at Dinfos, our motto is strength through truth. It's something that we try to embody as best we can. How important is truth to your job as a columnist and as a communicator?
Oh, it's everything. You can't make it up. I don't make up stuff. I was very disappointed years ago when another columnist that I admired, Mike Barnicle of the Boston Globe, he's on MSNBC Morning Joe now, but he has been for several years. I mean, he made up stuff, and the Globe found out about it and fired him. And I was so disappointed. I was devastated by that. I said, I've been reading you for, you know, you say you've been reading me for years. I was reading Mike Barnicle in the Globe for years. And then one day in his column, I'm reading the Boston Globe on a Sunday. It was 1998 or something like that. It goes back a ways. And I'm reading George Carlin jokes in his column that my younger brother recognized as George Carlin jokes. I said, come on, that can't be a George Carlin joke. This is Mike Barnicle's column. Well, it turned out he was. He took George Carlin jokes and put them in his column. And then he made up whole stories, some of them very emotional pieces that people had that people had found arresting, you know, and just loved. And it turns out in a Globe investigation that he had made them up. So you can't do that. You should be out of the business. In fact, I was disappointed that NBC gave him a job almost right away after that happened. I said, wait a minute, do you understand what he did? This is a cardinal sin in journalism.
For sure.
To make up a story. We don't do that. The New York Times had a reporter who made up a couple of stories, the New Republic. And when it happens, it hurts all of us. But we don't make it up. I always say with Baltimore, there have been so many kooky stories over the years that I've written about, so many unusual things that have happened. My motto is, Baltimore, you don't have to make it up. I mean, that would be a theme of a book. I could write a book with that title because just yesterday, there was a story that came in from the U.S. Attorney's Office about a guy who was a jilted lover, and what he decided to do with his jilt was really extraordinary. And I said to my wife after I read this, it was a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office, I said, you don't have to make stories up. You read all this fiction in novels. There's so much in real life that's true that you don't have to make anything up. But okay, so back to facts. When you're talking about what's going on today with disinformation, especially that one, this has become very difficult for me. I continue on my path. I don't make stuff up. And while I give my own take on things in a column, because that's what I'm assigned to do, a lot of people don't understand that. They think I'm a straight reporter. I'm not a straight reporter. I give my take on things, but it's based in facts. And even fairness, people think, well, you're not being fair. And if someone tells me I'm not being fair, I look at it and say, okay, let me think about this a minute. Am I being fair in my criticism of the mayor or this state delegate or whoever it is? Are you being fair? Have you looked at all of as many of the facts as you can? The problem I found in the last few years is, last several years now, is you state a fact to some people and they think it's your opinion. And I try to tell them, you're entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to make up facts. You know, here's a fact. I'm stating a fact, and some people just don't want to hear it. You know, they don't want to hear it. That's where we are today with our polarized politics, and it does affect our work. But you can't let it affect your work. You have to continue on if you're a reporter, a straight reporter. You have to try to be as objective as possible. People say it's impossible to be objective. It's a challenge, but you've got to try, especially if you're a reporter. What I do is a little different. You know, I'm allowed to give my take on things, but I try to be fair and I try to be factual. I hate to get something wrong. I hate to get a fact wrong. I pride myself on, having done this work since 1979 as a columnist and had maybe two dozen corrections published over all those years.
So what is your process for verifying that the facts you've been told are correct?
Well, yeah, this is very important today because people go online. We all go online and look up stuff, right? We Google things. I always look at the source, and there are sources that I've been trained to trust and have trusted over the years and still trust. And I do not when I see something that's asserted or published by a source I'm not familiar with, I check it out. If your mother says she loves you, check it out. That's an expression from the news business. So you got to be very careful. Usually I find with search engines, with Google, for instance, the first thing that pops up is usually something pretty credible. But you can get thrown off by that unless you look a little harder. So look at the source. You may be looking for something online that affirms what your belief is. Okay, like you want to find a story that says something, you want to find a story that affirms some negative thought you have about a politician, right? Well, you got to be careful there because your bias will take you there. A confirmation bias, it's called, right? So you have to be very careful about what the source of that is. And you have to be careful about what you look for. You have to have an open mind. I hate to say it. It's hard to have an open mind about things these days because people seem, all of us have our prejudices, and some people are really fixed in false information, and I don't know what to say to it. I get emails from people complaining about something the president did or something a Democrat did here and there, and I look a little further, and I think there's nothing to this. This is like was made. Do you realize that this was made up? You're reciting a fact. You think it's a fact, and it's not. I actually take my time with email and try to explain that to people, and it's not appreciated. That's a tough one. I'm not used to that.
So that actually leads me right into my next question, which is when you are in an interview or you're in a situation that necessitates asking those difficult or uncomfortable questions, how do you handle that?
Well, you just have to do it, right? I mean, that is your job. Some people in broadcasting, I noticed, are uncomfortable doing that. They want everyone to like them. Whereas newspaper reporters, I don't know, they don't care so much about that, whether somebody likes you or not. They're not going to like you. And, I found that when it comes to politicians in particular and people in the corporate world, they just – everything is very managed. You know, it's hard to get to them. To ask those questions sometimes. They don't want to be bothered. And they don't have to be. But they seem more reluctant than ever to face us. So it's not that easy to do that. You know, I tried to get an interview last couple of months with a very conservative politician who's running for Congress in Maryland. And he doesn't want to do it because he thinks I'm unfair. He thinks I'm too liberal. That's unfortunate. You know, he's missed an opportunity to convince me otherwise that maybe he has some good ideas. And so I guess he assumes that I'll be hostile or something like that. But that's not how you can't get an interview if you proclaim that, listen, I want to do a hostile interview with you. You have to make an effort to be open-minded about it. You have to be willing to do that. So, yeah, I know some people, especially if you're new to journalism, asking questions is tough. When I was a kid and getting started, I didn't want to walk up to a cop and ask him what happened here. You know, I was nervous about it. I didn't want to call somebody at home whose husband had just been killed in a car accident, and even if it was for an obituary, right? That is a tough situation. I was very nervous about it. But you know what I found is, I should mention this. We had Marines from Maryland killed in the Beirut truck bombing of 1982, and that was rough. That was, I think there were six or seven of them from Maryland, and I covered a couple of the funerals, and then I knocked on doors to speak to family members, and you always think, well, that's obtrusive, that's obnoxious. Why are you doing that? Leave them alone. Well, I found that people in those situations, most of them did want the attention. Well, not the attention. They did want to know that we cared enough to ask questions.
Wanted to be heard.
They wanted to be heard. They wanted us to give them voice to talk about their son, brother, uncle, husband that had just been killed in that tragedy. And I took that. It was fairly early in my career, and I took that as a lesson that, no, do it. Do it, because people do want to talk about this stuff, and if you make the right approach, they'll talk to you, and you'll get a story. You know,
things have certainly changed over the years, I would say. On a different note, how do you know a story is worth covering, and what kind of stories do you like to cover the most?
See, I'm a generalist. Call me generalissimo, generalist. I write about anything. I mean, I wrote about the Orioles last week, and this week I'm writing about mammals, horses, and dolphins. I'm going to write a piece about the mayor of Baltimore when I leave here, I think. They got to be stories that I think are interesting. It's my instinct that they're interesting to people. You know, not too deep into the weeds, right, about any particular subject. Although I find that newspaper readers now, especially, are really thirsting for information, right? They want the deeper story. We went through a period at newspapers where we wrote a lot of briefs. When USA Today was first published, which goes back now to the 80s, I think, their idea was to do everything in brief and maybe have one long story, but most of it was going to be news McNuggets. That's what we called it, news McNuggets. So we started doing that to some extent. The Sun and other local papers did it. And readers were not satisfied with that. They don't, yeah, maybe you can have some briefs here and there, some McNuggets, but people want a longer take on things. They want a deeper understanding of an issue. So we've done that. We take out on longer stories in the Sun all the time. I'm stuck with 900 words, but I managed to get a lot into 900 words, I think. So yeah, I think newspaper readers, we're down to the people who really want to be informed and want facts. Those are the people who continue to read newspapers. Thank God that they're doing it. And actually, our digital subscriptions at the Sun have started to go up again.
What other ways have you noticed that our career field has changed during this transition from traditional media to digital media?
Well, we were warned a long time ago that people were going to get most of their news from broadcasts, from television, through a lesser extent radio, than they would from the print newspaper. So the print probably is going to be history soon, and we'll be doing all our reading online. But what worries me is that that prophecy about 70% of people getting most of their news from television, cable or the network, is true. And now it's gotten higher. So my biggest worry is getting people to actually read news. Now, people think they read news when they go on Twitter and they read a synopsis or they read a headline. I notice on Facebook when I post my column, with a brief summation of what the column's about on Facebook when I post it. And I notice that people start commenting based on the brief summation and not what I've actually written. And that's a little frustrating because if they don't read the story, they don't know that I mentioned that, or yes, I covered that point. People think they read and they don't read as much, but they need to read more. And I don't know, how do we get people to read more? I mean, you look at the New York Times online.
Sure.
I mean, it's deep. It is rich. It is, to me, is a daily miracle that they put out so many stories about so many interesting things, from great recipes to what's going on with aquifers in the Midwest, right? They do all this deep reporting. They cover the war in Ukraine. That, to me, is amazing. And there's so much content. There's almost too much content for some people. But still, it's there. You got to read it. And I don't know how you get that from a 90-second report on CNN. You get some of it. I think you just got to read more. So, and I tell people who work in professional public relations, please read the newspaper. Please understand what we do before you try to pitch us a story. The other day, I had somebody pitch me a story, and I said to them, why would you pitch me this idea? This is not, I've never written about this, and you should direct this to the reporter who covers health, because this is not something I'd be interested in. Do you read the newspaper? And they hedged on the answer. I think if you're in public relations, public affairs, and you're trying to pitch stories, you got to know who you're pitching it to.
That's a great point.
And you have to read, yeah.
Is the, say, inability of your audience to delve deeper into the story one of the significant challenges that you see with communications today, or are there other ones that stand out to you?
Well, that is, yeah. The other one is the facts problem. You know, you state certain facts and you cite a source for it, and people still don't believe you, and they still think you have an agenda. And I'm talking about just straight reporters, not even me. I expect it because I do put my opinion into what I write. You know, it's by intention. But even reporters get this, you know, that the reader doesn't believe them, even though they cite a credible source. We had a lot of that during COVID and the reporting on COVID, it became so politicized too. You know, I wasn't really expecting that. I guess I should have. But, you know, the deeper reading, I think, as far as newspapers go, listen, I still work for a newspaper. I still love it and care about it. And I think our readers, people who are still reading a newspaper today or are coming back to newspapers digitally, are reading because they know they need to know, they need to get more information.
Is there a piece, I know you've this is going to be probably a difficult question, but is there any piece or product that you've been a part of over the years that you're most proud of?
Well, I'll go back to the subject of ex-offenders coming out of prison looking for jobs. So a little story about that. In 2005, I was writing three columns a week for The Sun, and we had a summer with more violence in it, and we had two people shot on a front porch on a Monday night, and I went over there to look at the neighborhood and drove around trying to figure out what to write about, you know? I said, what more can I say? Because you do, you hit these spots where you feel like, if you do this long enough, you feel like, I've said it, I've said everything there is to say. I don't have any more ideas. I don't know what to say about this anymore. So I decided to write a column. It was like a Dear Drug Dealers column, asking them to just take the summer off from killing each other, from shooting. And if they wanted to do something else with their lives besides sell drugs, call me at 410-332-6166. And I put the phone number in the newspaper. My editor thought I was crazy. And I just wanted to try something. Just something. I said, I'm just going to say this because maybe some of these guys will call me. Who knows what will happen? So I'll make a long story short. The phone started ringing at 4:30 a.m. A first voice message came into my message system at 4:30 a.m. from a guy who said he'd been in prison for 5 years, came out, had a wife and kids, wanted to support his family, was cutting grass, doing weed whacking, wasn't making enough money, and did I know where he could look for a job because he's gone to a couple of warehouses and got turned down. And so this opened up a whole thing. This sort of consumed my life for the next couple of years. I wrote about this a lot, and we stopped counting at 5,000 contacts, 5,000 phone calls, interviews, letters from people, mostly men, a lot of women too, but mostly men, who just couldn't find a job, had been turned down for jobs, rejected, had actually gone looking for work. So this is what I mean. It was like a sleeping giant of a story.
What should the young communicators that are just starting out know about being a communicator today?
Well, one thing I mentioned earlier is if you're communicating to media, to the news media, right, and not directly to the general public. So let's talk about that because that's the part I'm familiar with. If you're trying to get reporters interested in a story you have or coordinate coverage of something, you got to know who you're dealing with. You got to know who that public is, who those reporters are, what they cover, how they cover it. And just don't take a sort of shotgun approach to sending out press releases. Sometimes you have to do that. But it's good to target people who, I hate to use these gun-sounding terms, shotgun and target, but it's true. you gotta make the right approach to the right person with a story when you have a story idea. And you gotta think of story ideas first of all, right? And they gotta be interesting. So that's one thing, is be informed yourself and read newspapers, read magazines, and pay attention to what's going on in the news media so that you're not just sort of blindly sending out press releases hoping somebody will pick it up. Is that helpful to you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because I was wondering what kind of communicating they'd be doing in public affairs. They would be addressing the news media, right?
Well, our students do everything from photography to broadcasting to podcasts. And, you know, they cover the gamut in all forms of journalism and communications as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, are there any other tips or advice that you think you'd give to the young people today?
You know, we haven't figured it all out either. You know, I for a while there, I thought social media really enhances the reading that people will see something on Twitter and then want to read it. Now, I do. I use Twitter personally like a news service, right? I I follow news organizations on Twitter. If there's something there I find interesting, I click on it and read it, right? Some people just read what's on the Twitter part and leave it at that. So I don't know that that's a panacea either for getting more eyes on digital content at the Sun or any newspaper, any news organization. It must help to some degree, but I think we have to keep that. That's an important part, not just say, well, it's not working. I think the right approach in social media, you can get people's eyes on the content you've produced, the journalism you've produced.
It sounds like we're doing pretty good here at the schoolhouse. You know, we understand that the jack of all trades mentality is sort of where the career field is right now, and that's what we want to impart to our students, is that they should be knowledgeable and hopefully skilled at every aspect of the career field.
Yeah. I like it. I take my own photographs and I do my own writing, and I did a podcast for a while too and enjoyed that. So I feel like I've had all those experiences.
As you look forward, what do you think the future of our career field looks like?
Yeah, that's interesting. Boy, I hope we can get past this polarization in America for lots of reasons. One is we need to have a fully informed society, people with more open minds toward what's happening, because we got some big problems to solve. And that's what I worry about, whether people are going to break through their own prejudice, all of us, break through our own prejudices and listen to the other side, or keep an open mind about having a fact-based system, you know, and making policy decisions that are fact-based and sound and humane. That's what I worry about. But so I tell professional journalists, please do your job. The Sun, we have these young people who've come out of college, and we've hired them. They worked for local newspapers for a little while, and they came to the Sun, and they are hungry. They love this work, and it shows. I'm very impressed with the people. They're all in their 20s, and they're good. They work hard, and they seem to understand that what their job is to report facts first, primarily report facts and spell people's names correctly, you know. So you know, I really like that. I'm glad they don't all want to be columnists. They don't. I don't see that.
You know, I could literally keep you here all day, I think, talking about this stuff and listening to stories, and I'm not going to do that to you. But I did have one last question for you, which I guess would be, is there anything that we haven't talked about or anything that you would add that you think that the young people just getting into this career field need to know before they go out there and be professionals?
Yeah, I guess I want to emphasize again what I just said, really.
Sure.
This is foundational to democracy. That sounds like people say all that, you know, it sounds like, what are you talking about? Yeah, but it's true. I mean, you have to have agreed upon set of facts in order for the state legislature, the city council, the Congress to enact laws that benefit the society, right? So, and we can't have a society that ignores problems or just blames somebody else all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So stick to the facts, follow the truth where it leads, and make sure you do your part to get it out there. That's what I would say. It's so important. I always feel like this is self-serving, you know, when I get to this part about journalism. Journalism matters. I mean, it really does. So many big decisions in our society are based on the facts we come up with, you know, understanding science, or respecting people in science and medicine and health, people who spend a lot of time studying climate problems. And, you know, they're not doing this because they have some kind of agenda where they want to tear down the capitalistic system or something. You know, they're doing this because they have kids and grandchildren, and we want to see a future world that's livable, right? So, yeah, we need to have a set of facts based on to move forward, and a lot of that emanates from journalism. We're the sort of the iron core of information. This is the part I worry about. I worry about the iron core getting smaller. That's This is a professor at Harvard who came up with this term about the iron core, where you have the mainstream news media, which is the newspapers I've mentioned during this podcast, that I still believe and trust that is based in professional journalism, the wire services, Associated Press, Reuters, the BBC, NPR, the major networks that form the iron core of journalism. And if you don't have that, and local news, another thing, and a lot of local news in there, if you don't have that, I don't know what, you know, it's going to fall apart. So we have to keep that sound and support it. People have to pay for it. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us. This has been
a pleasure.
It's truly been a fascinating conversation, and I appreciate you coming in so much. And if we can get you to come back again, I promise next time we'll talk more about the Orioles.
Okay, we could do that. And I'd be glad to speak to one of your classes, too.
I would love that.
All right, John.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.